6:48, Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, joined by Hannah Scott. It took close to 4 years, but Seattle Police have a new contract, and it comes with a big pay raise, and it comes with plenty of controversy. City Hall was packed as people had their say pro and con. Hannah?
So in the days and weeks leading up to this vote, Community Police Commission and dozens of activist groups lobbied the council to reject the contract, saying that it rolled back reforms. While the mayor, the police chief, Police Officers Guild, they all pushed for approval, saying it was long overdue and that it absolutely protected reforms. Now, the judge overseeing the reforms under the consent decree last week expressed some concerns, nothing very specific about the contract, but he said he wouldn't do anything or weigh in until the council took a vote. So that set the stage for yesterday, where people on both sides packed City Hall to have their say before the vote. From the opposition,
this contract flies in the face of the work that communities have been doing for years to achieve police accountability in a way that we can at least have a way to access justice.
Going back to 2010, when John T. Williams was murdered and Officer Ian Burke got away with it without being prosecuted, we need police reform.
This isn't about whether or not people are making a living wage, because people are making a living wage. People are also dying.
There were plenty of people, though, in support of the contract and the police department, including a large showing from the Chinatown International District.
These folks need to be able to do their work and know that they're supported.
If we don't keep up with law and order, you're going to have chaos.
We, as an elderly community in the Chinatown, every one of us support the new contract. Support.
And before the vote, Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez was urging a yes vote from her colleagues, and she had added a resolution that asked the city attorney to request a review from that federal judge overseeing the consent decree of highlighted areas of concern that she put into that resolution. They include the allowance to recalculate the 180-day timeline for misconduct investigations, new limits on subpoena authority for the Office of Police Accountability and the Office of Inspector General. Those are two of the three civilian-led SPD oversight agencies that were created under accountability legislation that the council passed last year. Also, the change on the standard for the burden of proof in misconduct investigations, which under the new contract is elevated to more than a preponderance of the evidence for firing officers when what they're accused of is something that would be stigmatizing to them in future law enforcement, trying to get a job somewhere else in law enforcement. Seven of the nine council members had to approve this going in. Shama Sawant was already a no vote. Michael Bryan and Lisa Herbold were the ones considered to be wild cards. O'Brien moved into the yes column, noting that reforms were an ongoing process that would continue in the future. Herbold also moved into the yes column, but reluctantly, because saying that there was no path to both deal with the problems in the contract and get cops their raises.
Unfortunately, I feel like the negotiation process at this juncture does allow us to do both. It only allows us to act on the shared value as it relates to the economic package. It doesn't allow us to continue to work on the identified shortcomings on the accountability. So consequently, I regretfully intend to vote yes today.
In the end, it passed 8-1, as did Gonzalez's resolution asking for judicial review. A big win for Chief Carmen Best, who vowed to stay committed to reforms and accountability.
The vote today clearly shows that the council is supporting the officers and cares about the work that they're doing. We are moving forward, looking ahead to continuously innovating and making sure that we have a culture where the officers are doing the work and the community is showing that they support them.
But a battle cry for people like Andre Taylor, whose brother was killed by Seattle police in 2016. He tells Cairo 7 the contract guts the celebrated police accountability legislation the council passed last year.
You want to blow that up? That's what you have done. So now I'm in a position to have to go to war again. Not because I want to, but because the community that has nothing demands it of me.
What does that mean exactly?
We'll see. So Andre Taylor, just so you know, is one of the driving forces behind Initiative I-940 that just passed the police accountability legislation. So remains to be seen what reaction they and other activists.
He doesn't think that initiative is enough.
No.
To keep police in line, as he would say.
Yeah. And again, the Initiative 940 does not address the wide range of things that fall under both the police accountability legislation that was passed by the city last year, as well as the consent decree reforms that are mandated. So also the federal judge will now have to review this contract. While it did pass, he will look at it. There are several items that have been identified as possible areas of concern under the consent decree, which would be where his jurisdiction lies.
Is there a sense that because of the whole history here, communities are still not cooperating with the police when it comes to solving crimes?
Or absolutely. There's really? Definitely, especially among some of these activist groups. I talked to the local NAACP president yesterday, and I asked him, I said, don't you think the police have made some progress? And he said, they may have made some progress, but there's still a massive amount of mistrust among our communities.
Well, even with the new police chief, huh?
So far, yeah.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. One of the remarkable things about the election is that Washington State passed a sweeping gun control measure. Initiative 1639 wasn't even close. 60% of the vote. It requires a lot of things, including ongoing training, background checks. We've talked before with Dr. Garen Wintemute. He's director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. He's an emergency room physician. He has conducted studies into gun violence for more than 30 years. Dr. Wintemute, do you think measures like this will do any good? Sometimes we seem to pass things based on the last event. Is there any evidence that initiatives like Initiative 1639 will prevent future mass shootings?
There is, in general, an argument, and I make it sometimes, that solutions narrowly crafted to the last event, whatever that event was, won't prevent the next one. But from my understanding of the initiative, what's proposed here is really pretty broad. And what we look for in public health is solutions that are broad enough that while they may be directed at mass shootings, they will have a broader effect on firearm violence. We've just got to remember that public mass shootings, the ones we all know about, account for no more than about 1% of deaths from firearm violence. They don't even account for most mass shootings. Most mass shootings are not public events. One of the difficulties here, and it kind of goes back to your first point, is we are always trying to find the one thing that will fix the problem. And there is no such one thing, or we'd have it in place by now. Yeah. We're going to have to keep trying different solutions, different potential solutions, based on all the facts we have at the time.
Of course, that's what causes the divide here, because gun owners who do abide by the law and are never in a million years going to shoot up a line dance see their lives made more complicated as progressives search for those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things that they can do to prevent the next mass shooting, which you yourself point out really only accounts for a minute percentage of the gun deaths in the country.
Right. Now, to give the opposite side of the argument about the minute percentage, mass shootings are fundamentally different. The public ones are. Let's just be upfront about it.
Yeah.
They are the one form of firearm violence about which nobody can come up with a story that leaves themselves out. Public mass shootings are in the process of changing the character of American public life, and not for the better. We're fearful. People make escape plans when they go to the mall. They
right.
think about, do I take my kids or not? And other forms of firearm violence just didn't do that. But when it comes to policy, one of the, as I see it at least, one of the benefits of something like a gun violence restraining order is it will never be used for all of those millions of people who buy firearms that are never going to think about using them to harm themselves or others in any unsanctioned way. But it's there for the very small percentage of people for whom it might apply. The other one that's been an active issue in Washington, obviously, is background checks, having background checks for all firearm purchases. And yes, it's a little bit inconvenient to go through a background check, but the overwhelming majority of firearm owners, let alone the general public, support such legislation. They understand that this is a little bit of inconvenience for us in exchange for a safer society, and people are willing to make that bargain.
Did you notice anything in the last election indicating that there are even gun owners running out of patience with the way that we make it way too easy for the wrong people to get weapons?
Well, I can't say for sure that it was gun owners running out of patience. But one thing that we all are seeing, and it's becoming actually clearer as the slow count results come in, is that there is an interest, I think it's a reasonable inference, that there is an interest in doing more about firearm policy than we have done. In Georgia, if I recall the state correctly, there's been elected to Congress a woman who was in came into politics because of her son's murder. In Pennsylvania, there was a race where gun control, as they used, as they described it, it's not a term I like, was the leading issue in the campaign, with the candidates sort of trying to outdo each other as pro-regulation sorts of people. And here in California, where I live, it's become very clear. Our governor-elect has put firearm policy front and center. It's going to be one of his major areas of focus.
That's Gavin Newsom. What's the term you prefer to gun control?
I use firearm violence prevention. It's not about controlling guns, not fundamentally, not only. Our interest is in preventing the misuse of firearms. To me, that encompasses a lot of territory. It means that there are people who should not be permitted to purchase or possess firearms. I think personally that it means that there are categories of firearms that should not be in general civilian circulation. But gun control is a term that, at least for me, outlived its usefulness about 20 years ago.
Dr. Garen Wintemute is director of the Violence Prevention Research Program, UC Davis, and an emergency room physician. And Dr. Wintemute, always good to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me back.
Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. I thought the hockey arena thing was pretty much a done deal, and suddenly doubt has been raised by whom?
Well, it's a question about the timeline, and hey, have they been able to say? They've never said, we are certain, we are on schedule, we will absolutely have the arena done by 2020. That's been saying, we think we're going to get it done. We think we can do it. We know it's an aggressive schedule. And right now, I think that there continues to be, it's going to be, it would be a surprise to me if it's done in time for the 2020 season.
Well, now, wasn't one of the reasons that the city was so eager to take this deal is that they had that quick timeline and had the best chance of bringing hockey to Seattle on schedule?
Well, hockey's still going to come here. Okay. It's just a question of which season.
So then who's
it's
raising
be for.
This was a statement from the NHL saying what?
Well, they're not sure if it's going to be there. They have to make plans for how many teams are going to be in the league, how many are going to be able to play. And I think that we've seen a few delays from the formal announcement of the NHL about the franchise and when it's going to be there. It was expected to happen back in June, and it didn't. And hey, all the trains have to be on time, I think was Gary Bettman's quote. And the reason is because they've got to know when the team is going to be ready to play here, because there's no temporary home for them to play. They can't play in another ice hockey arena here, because neither the Showwear Center nor Everett would be suitable for NHL games.
Oh, why is that, too small?
I think so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hmm. So is there supposed to be a vote in December from the Board of Governors
on if
we get a franchise?
To formally approve the franchise.
And that's expected to happen.
Well, they're going to get a team. I don't think anybody thinks that Seattle's not going to get a team. The question is, do they set it for the season 2020? They've been burned in the past. They granted an expansion franchise to Quebec City, which has never gotten back and gotten its arena in gear. That was several years ago.
Whoa.
And the expansion never happened because they weren't able to cross all the T's and dot the I's.
Well, without that commitment, does that change the investors' decision to move forward? Or they're going to go ahead and build it anyway, right?
Yeah, no, everything's moving ahead. This is a debate over timeline.
Okay.
This is not a debate over whether Seattle gets a franchise. This is a debate over timeline. I don't think it's the most unusual thing for a contractor to have a somewhat specious deadline to when the construction project will be done. There's a lot of things like, we really think, we hope to have it done.
Okay, well, I'm not going to worry about it.
And Todd Lewicki said that he thinks they can get it done, and he's usually someone who's doesn't overpromise and underdeliver.
That's for sure on the traffic count, too. Any developments on how they're going to mitigate traffic when all of this is said and done?
Well, there's going to be traffic. I mean, how are you going to create? Oh, yeah. There's going to be traffic.
There's traffic when there's an opera, and that's only 2,800 people.
All you need to know is that in their traffic mitigation plan, I believe it's step 5 of 7 involves cars.
What do you mean?
That means
improving car access.
Yeah. So
everything else is mass
the way
traffic.
They think it's going to get better cars is number five on the list. So people who bike to the games, people who walk to the games, people who take light rail and then this and then the connector and then will walk or catch a Lime bike to the game. That's their plan.
Sounds like a good idea, slogging your children down the light rail and walking to the Key Arena.
Why not?
I'm still upset about the fact that they're like, nah, it should have no impact on traffic. We'll be fine. Bye.
Well, they're building it. Why should they mitigate the traffic? If they're building the arena, if they're building it, why should they mitigate the traffic?
That's like any city saying, well, you're going to build us gobs of apartments, so you shouldn't have to think about traffic. It's irresponsible in my mind.
It's irresponsible for them to build an arena there?
I'm not saying it's irresponsible to build an arena. I'm saying it's irresponsible not to consider that this will have a significant impact on an already messy Mercer Street. And how can we resolve that? Or how can we come to a compromise on resolving that with the city?
With Husky games, they have just, you know, platoons of buses and people take those, right?
Yeah, and they've talked about the monorail. They're building what is going to be a civic asset and bringing a hockey team here
Absolutely.
That will make a lot of people happy.
I'm
so
not
the idea
that
they should solve traffic problems for the city.
No, and you're taking this to extreme and you're using hyperbole. I'm not saying solve our traffic problem. I'm not saying it's not a good idea to build the arena. I love the idea. What I'm saying is that traffic seems to be an afterthought when that's one of our major issues here in Seattle.
Yeah, and I would say that the city should have fixed Mercer a long time ago instead
Absolutely.
Of remodeling it so, and to create more bus or more bike thoroughfare and that increasing the
Absolutely.
Capacity.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
We have those 8-person bicycles now.
And don't forget, when light rail to Ballard is complete sometime in the 2036 time frame, there will be a light rail station near or under Seattle Center.
Can't wait.
So you'll be able to take that to the games.
Okay. In 2036?
Well, I'm not sure if they open that line before they get it all the way to Ballard, but yeah, they got a tunnel first.
Cool.
On homelessness, yet again, we've been hearing from local leaders about the need for some sort of regional approach, and now it looks like the state could actually get involved. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here to talk about that. And what I noticed that's interesting to me is that there are ideas now coming from the Republican side of the aisle.
Right. Yeah. So this is a big deal. Democrats managed to get a handful of bills passed last session through to help with affordable housing and homelessness issues. And a lot of there was some bipartisan support for some of those, but largely Republicans were against a good many of them. But now that Democrats have grown the majority, we're hearing from Republicans. A handful of senators got together yesterday and unveiled packages that they're working on to help get more affordable housing out there statewide. Everybody agrees that the lack of that is really a big part of what's leading to all of the homelessness issues we have. So Republican Senator Randy Becker, she has ideas for property tax exemptions for some seniors and disabled veterans to help keep them from going into homelessness. On Republican Senator Hans Ziegler also has several proposals, largely focused on tiny houses, including changes in the law for accessory dwelling units or ADUs that right now require they be attached to a home. So to make it easier for people to have tiny houses on their property, he wants to change that. He also wants to change how we go about dealing with tiny house villages.
Tiny houses can be a viable option for some Washingtonians if we create a regulatory framework for them to exist. And so let's see what can happen if we open that up. We should allow tiny house developments outside of urban growth areas. One of the goals of the Growth Management Act certainly is to respect rural character, and I think that we should uphold that. And I think tiny houses are a low-impact way that we can encourage some limited growth while maintaining that rural character.
That sounds like a breakthrough to me, because one of the things that you notice in areas where they set aside certain land to be green belts and things
right.
like that, is you drive up property prices everywhere else. If you're allowed to use some of that land in a low impact way, you're not harming the environment, but you're also taking pressure off the housing market.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, there's among these, we're nearly 20 proposals that were discussed yesterday. There are proposals to tweak the Growth Management Act as far as regulations go like that, to make it easier to develop all around and in urban areas specifically. So a lot of those type of proposals when we're talking about regulations and things like that. Ziegler also wants to take a aim at dealing with the homelessness issue, though.
A new state program that will allow cities to hire homeless adults to get a short-term job with the hope of long-term employment. We have this opportunity where local governments can contract with the state of Washington to go out and do conservation projects. It's a foot in the door for a lot of people to do meaningful work, and we also have a track specifically for veterans. What I'm proposing is a new program that would focus on homeless adults.
So
great idea.
Yeah, some really good ideas. And another one he wants to do is further reforms at DSHS that was essentially, when we're talking about services, give more of that control over to the local jurisdictions, allowing them to get things that so people don't have to go straight through DSHS, allowing cities and counties to kind of streamline that.
And I assume the Democrats would be on board with this, right?
Yeah. So Democrats point out that a lot of these same lawmakers, these Republicans that made this announcement yesterday, voted against a lot of the bills Democrats got through on this issue last session. But they're excited to hear from them right now about this and hope that that means that we're going to have some bipartisanship and passage and sense of urgency on housing and homelessness bills in this next session. Meantime, Democrat State Representative Nicole Macri, who led efforts on homeless and housing legislation last session, already has new proposals on her side of the aisle.
We will seek to extend a lot more resource into the creation of affordable housing. So housing for the lowest income people through investments in our housing trust fund, credit back to local communities, sales tax revenue, so they can use their own local bonding authority to create capital dollars to build housing in their own communities. We also want to help communities with the tools that they need to create housing as quickly as possible.
And again, that means doing a lot of revamping of regulations, cutting away all the red tape that really it can take years to get all of this affordable housing online. So more people become homeless and then you need more. You can never catch up. So that's really what I'm getting from both sides of the aisle is a dramatic sense of urgency to get all that red tape out of the way, possibly make some further investments in some of these subsidies that help pay for affordable housing and do this not just in the Seattle area and the big cities, but statewide, because it's really a problem that's growing across the state.
That sounds like good news.
It is. Remains to be seen.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There's a new study out which links the kind of dangers you face as a child with the aging process. And it's a study by Katie Ann McLaughlin. And you were affiliated with the University of Washington at one time, Katie?
That's right. I was a professor at the University of Washington when I conducted this research.
Right. You've since gone on to Harvard. Why would it occur to you to look for signs of aging in children who've been through some sort of trauma?
One of the things that we've learned over the past decade is that exposure to trauma and adversity in childhood is a powerful predictor of your health in adulthood. So kids who experienced violence, exposure to other sorts of threats, have higher rates of a whole range of chronic diseases, ranging from cardiovascular disease and diabetes to cancer. And the mechanisms that explain this are really unclear. And one possibility that we've begun to explore is that growing up in a dangerous environment can actually begin to accelerate the aging process from a biological perspective, which is exactly what we found in this study.
So when you talk about the aging process, is this something you observe on a cellular level? I mean, does it mean that you go through puberty earlier? And how do you measure an accelerated aging process?
In this study, we used two different measures of aging. One of them is a relatively simple measure, which just looks at how quickly the children are going through puberty relative to their age. You can see for a child, let's say, of 12, are they farther along in pubertal development than another child of that same age who hasn't experienced some form of adversity? And the second metric we used is actually a cellular measure of aging. It's called a DNA methylation age, which is a mouthful, but essentially is sort of a biological clock that typically correlates very strongly with your chronological age. And what we found in these children is that this sort of cellular aging clock suggested that they were aging much faster than their peers if they had experienced violence.
Wow. So in other words, this affects the entire body?
Absolutely. That's what we think. These DNA methylation aging clocks are taken from cells that exist all over the body, and they suggest kind of a general acceleration in how fast the body is aging.
Okay. So this is real then. And the next question is obviously, what types of incidents rise to a level that would cause this kind of accelerated aging? Can you give us some examples?
Absolutely. So one of the things that's interesting in what we found is that the types of adversity that triggered this accelerated aging were relatively specific. And they generally involved experiences that involve a high degree of threat or danger. Exposure to abuse would be an extreme example, but also other types of exposure to violence, like witnessing violence in your community or witnessing violence between your parents. All of these experiences sort of send a signal to the body that there's a threat around, that the environment is dangerous. And in contrast, when we looked at other types of adversity that don't involve danger, that involve instead deprivation of some kind, like growing up without secure access to food, being neglected, or growing up in poverty, those types of adversities were not associated with accelerated aging. And so the findings were really specific to experiences that involve danger or some kind of threat to the child.
I know people who believe that over time you come to resemble what you've been through. It sounds like that's almost what you're finding evidence of here.
Absolutely. And it makes perfect sense, right? I mean, our brains are designed to adapt to the environments that we develop in. And we see in lots of ways that kids who grow up in adverse early environments are demonstrating adaptations that might actually be sort of perfectly adaptive for them in those dangerous or threatening environments, but can have a toll later. So, for example, one reason that the body might accelerate its aging process if you're in a dangerous environment is so that you can get to reproductive maturity essentially before you die, right? That if it's dangerous, you want to kind of hurry up and get to a point where you can reproduce from an evolutionary perspective. And so that might be adaptive on the one hand, but what we're seeing here is that as we live longer, this could have a toll on both physical health and mental health.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like when you pluck a flower, the plant suddenly goes into reproduction mode and grows even more blossoms. And so we're biological creatures, so that makes sense. But it also seems to imply that when we look at kids who, let's say, start having sex at an early age and assume that this is evidence of moral turpitude, in fact, it could be just nature's reaction to that child's environment.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the more that we learn about the long-term consequences of adverse early environments, the more we realize that, you know, many of the things that we might call problematic or deficits are actually perfectly adaptive in some sense for the child in the environment they're being raised in. The problem, of course, is that those adaptations to being in a dangerous or threatening environment can then have long-term consequences for our health, for our relationships, and for other areas of functioning.
Katie McLaughlin is an assistant professor at Harvard and led this study while she was on the UW faculty at the Department of Psychology. Katie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Viva, viva, Sita. How did I miss that hit?
That's a great one. Robin Hitchcock, fabulous song.
Everything that gives the community its unique characters, changing or vanishing in Seattle, blah, blah, blah. You've heard that a million times around here. Well, historian Felix Bunnell is sick of it, and so he is here with his list of things that have not changed, brought to us by the King County Library System. What has not changed?
Well, you know, I'm first to acknowledge here, one day after the 167th anniversary of the arrival of the city-founding Denny Party at Alki, that I think change is good, and that the more Seattle and the Seattle area changes, the more interesting it gets. If we ever stop, I think I'm done with Seattle. But that being said, I do have a sentimental streak. I like to find things that have one way or another resisted the change that's been so fast-paced and destructive around here. I have this highly subjective, non-comprehensive list of 10 or so public places. First on my list, in no particular order, of course, Crest Movie Theater in Shoreline. I think movies are still $4 there. Its last major quote-unquote renovation was in 1980, when they took what had been a single auditorium and cut it up into several little multiplexes. And it's, you know, if you know where to look, there's in the men's room, there's a great no loitering sign. Looks like it's been there since 1949 when the theater was built. And vintage theaters are there's very few of them left anymore.
And they'll let you see that sign for free, huh?
Yeah, well, you have to pay $4 to get in.
I see.
Second on my list is the Allweg Seattle Center Monorail.
Yes.
Sure, it's crashed and burned a few times, and they've updated some invisible, you know, safety systems, but it's still the same basic ride that even Elvis took back and forth to the fair in 1962. It gets bonus points in my mind along Fifth Avenue, where those wonderful pylons, which you can actually legally drive as a slalom course if you want. Just last night, I changed lanes a few times.
You cannot do that.
There's a single white line. It's not a double yellow line.
But they're
I changed lanes twice last night between like the where the Grosvenor House is, way down there.
Trust me, I've done it too. But it's not legal.
It's not legal.
Sure, I
spread that.
I'll confirm that.
No, don't ruin it. Don't ruin it for me. Keep that a secret. Actually, whenever people come from out of town, we used to go to Boeing Surplus. That's of course closed now. But the second attraction on the list was doing the slalom course on Fifth Avenue. You signal. You have to look both ways. You don't hang a left turn or a right turn.
Move on.
Anyway. The Athenian restaurant at Pike Place Market. I went there as a kid in 1980. It hasn't changed a bit. It's a little bit, it's in Sleepless in Seattle, so it got a little bit of fame 25 years ago. And it's, like most of the Pike Place Market, there's still places you can find that haven't changed that much. And the Athenian's my favorite. But you could also, in this restaurant category, I'd throw in the Roanoke Inn on Mercer Island.
Oh,
you
yes.
Ever go there?
Oh, yes, I have gone.
What a wonderful place. It hasn't changed a bit.
That's where the ferry landing used to be.
Yeah, exactly. And at some point, the Roanoke Inn will just sink into the earth, and no one will notice. It's just geologic time will reclaim it.
It is always packed, by the way.
Oh, it's a great place. Yeah. I mean, I used to go there. I worked on Mercer Island years ago, and we went there for lunch once a week. The Fremont Troll under the Fremont Bridge. Yes. Again, standing in for lots of public art. We had this 1% for the arts ordinance back in the 1970s, one of the first cities to do this. And so all these public art projects were created, and they let people interact with their environment. And because they're publicly funded and their art, they don't change a bit. So that's almost 30 years old now. The Bon Marché parking garage on 3rd Avenue. I think it's called Macy's now, the store across the street. I'm
yes,
not positive.
It is.
And it keeps shrinking and shrinking. I think there's maybe like a couple hundred square feet where they have like shirts and slacks on sale and maybe a few high heel shoes.
What's the big deal with the garage, though?
It hasn't changed a bit. It was built in 19...
That's certainly true.
Well, no, but it's emblematic of that battle that downtown Seattle was waging in the late 50s and early 60s against the suburbs to remain vital and relevant. And that parking garage let people drive their big cars and park them and shop downtown. And it worked. And I was in there a couple days ago. It hasn't changed a bit. I mean, there's a rental car place in there now. The elevator lobbies are the same. The actual parking areas have been restriped, countless times to make the spot smaller, probably.
Yeah.
But the actual physical feel of it hasn't changed a bit.
That is not the only parking deck that hasn't changed in downtown Seattle, Felix.
Well, it's one of the oldest ones that's still operated and hasn't been highly renovated.
Not the sinking ship one in Pioneer Square. That's too ugly for you,
see,
isn't
that,
it?
No, that's a good one, too. No, that's good. No, see, that's good. I mean, I know my list is not comprehensive. I know this, and this is highly subjective.
I'm just saying, if you're going to put parking decks on the list, which I question,
well,
you have to include
first
that
they
one.
Came for the parking decks, and I said nothing. I love all, the more totalitarian-looking something is, the more brutalist it is, the
you
better
like it,
I like it, because it's real. Eckstein Middle School's on my list, too. Their restrooms are like a museum of 1940s plumbing with some of the most gorgeous 1940s fixtures, probably highly inefficient.
You
probably
want a classic
75
men's
gallons of flush.
The old boys' room at Crown Hill Elementary up in Ballard.
Exactly.
Check that out.
Our schools are hidden gems in the neighborhoods of all this great architectural stuff. So we have the whole list at mynorthwest.com. I'd love to hear about stuff, especially out in the suburbs that I wasn't able to get to. Comment there. Let us know if there's places we've missed because, again, Seattle keeps changing, thank God, but it's nice some things stay the same.
Felix Spinello joins us each Wednesday. His features are on MyNorthwest.com. Anytime you want to read them.